On Masters of Scale, we talk a lot about inflection points, those moments when a technology stops being optional and starts being fundamental. AI presents one of those moments, and behind every breakthrough, whether it's medical research or education or even cinematic visual effects, there's infrastructure most people never see. As the essential cloud for AI, CoreWeave is building that foundation. It provides a purpose-built AI cloud designed specifically for pioneers at leading AI labs and enterprises, ready to power the biggest ideas and the boldest ambitions. Ready for anything, ready for AI. To learn more about how CoreWeave powers the world's best AI, go to coreweave.com/ready for anything. As your company scales, the hardest part isn't ambition, it's alignment. That's why Atlassian built the Teamwork Collection, an AI-powered teamwork platform designed to help teams move faster together. By connecting Jira, Confluence, Loom, and Rovo, teams can easily align work to real business goals, plan and track progress together, remove knowledge silos, and access the real magic of AI plus human collaboration. Visit Atlassian.com/teamchanger to learn more. That's Atlassian.com/teamchanger.
Startups grow in unpredictable ways, but your infrastructure shouldn't. Deel scales with you from employee one to employee 1,000. Deel's real-time payroll engine cuts weeks-long cycles down to minutes, and their global experts keep you compliant as you expand. Plus, startups can tap into perks like up to $25,000 in Deel credits and support programs designed specifically for high-growth teams. Deel is the fastest way to hire, manage, pay, and equip anyone, anywhere. Deel, your forever people platform. Visit deel.com/MOS to learn more and book a demo.
It was the biggest crisis that I've ever managed through in my professional career. Right, to think about your entire business being shut down, you have no revenue coming in, you have a massive burn rate, and you have thousands of employees who are all looking at you.
Amy Howe was at the helm of Ticketmaster in 2020 when the COVID pandemic brought the world to a screeching halt. Thousands of concerts canceled overnight, pro sports paused, customers demanding refunds. As Amy shepherded Ticketmaster through the unprecedented chaos, another company noticed her steady hand. That company, FanDuel. The fantasy sports startup turned sports betting juggernaut was looking for a seasoned leader. Suddenly, Amy had a real decision to make.
My whole career has been sliding door moments, right? Those unexpected turns that take you in one direction. And I think one of the things that's been really helpful for me is I was always willing to walk through doors that were open for me that I wasn't necessarily planning on walking through. But once I did, it opened up a whole new world.
This is Masters of Scale. I'm Jeff Berman, your host. And this week on the show, Amy Howe. She's the CEO of FanDuel, the market leader in sports betting. With a market cap of more than $25 billion, it's at the epicenter of a rapidly growing and somewhat controversial industry. I spoke with Amy about her strategy for prediction markets, navigating an evolving legal landscape, and the increasingly prominent place of gambling in the lives of millions of Americans. Amy, welcome to Masters of Scale.
Thank you. It's so fun to be here.
I'm so excited to have you, especially Super Bowl week, having this conversation. Why did you take the job at FanDuel?
So if I rewind the clock to set the scene, it was COVID. At the time, I was running Ticketmaster. We'd just kind of gone through the digital transformation. And I'm guessing you remember where you were when the world shut down. The NBA suspended their season. Do you remember that?
So I was on a week-long retreat with no access to the outside world. And as I came out of it, they told us that March Madness had been canceled, the NBA suspended its season. being offline for 7 days was as if I'd been Rip Van Winkle.
I'm sure your text was blowing up, right?
Yeah, crazy. Yeah.
But it was March 2020. The NBA suspended their season. And then, you know, from there, the dominoes fell, right? And I was running Ticketmaster at the time for North America. I think we had 54,000 events that were live on the platform. Literally overnight, they all were either canceled or postponed. And, you know, you've got everybody and their brother asking, how do they get their refunds back? And, you know, we went through a period of time where it was just, you're in crisis mode, right? The live entertainment world and obviously the sports world shut down. And so we're just managing through the crisis, trying to be a empathetic leader who nobody gives you a playbook, as it turns out, for how you manage during a pandemic. It has never happened to any of us.
It's been 100 years.
Certainly
so hard to run the same playbook.
Hasn't happened to the live entertainment industry. And fast forward several months, and somebody from FanDuel reached out and said, you know, hey, we're looking for a president position. We'd love for you to come over. And long story short, after hemming and hawing and saying, well, I'm not sure I can leave Ticketmaster right now, I knew that sports betting was taking off, right? You couldn't go to a sports industry conference at the time without hearing about just this explosive growth of online sports betting. And so it was a little bit of a leap of faith. I knew that, you know, I could come in, professionalize the industry, and bring a lot of the pattern recognition from having been a partner at McKinsey for so many years.
You were not hired as CEO, but you became CEO very quickly. How did that come to pass?
Well, I was hired as president. Matt King at the time was looking for somebody to ultimately succeed him. And after a few months, I'll never forget this. Mind you, this is during COVID, right? I hadn't met a single person face-to-face. I did all my interviews over Zoom. And I think I finally met Matt in New York. And, you know, Matt decided it was time for him to move on. And he had an opportunity to go work for Michael Rubin at Fanatics. And I stepped into the interim CEO role when he left. I was still very new to the industry, right? This was a few months after I started, so I was still coming up to speed.
What was it about the team that made you so excited to work with them?
When I met the top team, when I met Christian and Matt and so many of the other folks, the Andy Giancamelli, who was COO at the time, I could see myself working with them day in and day out, right? I mean, you think about it, we spend more time with our colleagues than we do at times, our family and friends, and you really have to like, trust, and respect that team. But the other thing that really drew me to FanDuel, and it was this company lives their principles and the values in a way that I've literally never seen any other company, right? And, you know, most people can recite them. We talk about being humble and hungry, which is hugely relevant in today's world where things are changing so quickly, right? We are one team. We're going to win with integrity. We say thank you. So these principles are not just a nice placard that are on the wall, but they literally drive the behavior of the top team and the entire organization. And that was meaningful to me.
For someone who spent 15 years at McKinsey, having looked at dozens, if not hundreds of companies, how were those values so deeply imbued in not just the company, but in the teams that they weren't just on a wall, but they were lived? And how have you carried that forward as CEO?
Well, FanDuel, if you think about the online sports betting industry, gosh, has it gone through a lot of twists and turns, and many of these predated me. But, you know, 2016, the daily fantasy sport business, this was before real money wagering was legal, but the entire industry was almost shut down, and the New York State Legislature saved it at the last minute, right? And then, you know, fast forward to 2018, when, ironically, the Supreme Court repealed what used to be a federal ban on online sports betting. And, you know, that opened up the market. But a lot of these folks were there from the early days. And when you meet them, you'll understand they're high integrity, hardworking, humble people that want to build an organization. They want to be successful. They want to be the number one players, but they want to do it the right way. And when I came into the organization, a lot of CEOs want to come in and change things. And I knew what was important. I, you know, was not an expert yet in online sports betting. So I did a lot of listening and learning and getting up to speed. But I said, these values are great. Why would I change them? Mm. But having come from, you know, McKinsey, which also has a very strong culture, I brought a lot of that pattern recognition as well. And I think one of the most important principles that I brought from McKinsey was what they talk about is the obligation to dissent, right? From day one, when you come in, if you're a business analyst out of undergrad, or I came in as an associate out of Wharton, you are taught to have a voice, right? And You're in rooms with partners who may have been there for 20 years, but they hired you for a reason and they want to hear your perspective. And that has always stuck with me, right? I mean, I think about our greatest asset as FanDuel are our people. We have nearly 5,000 people all around the world, and we hire them for a reason. So I think it's important to kind of to create an environment where people feel comfortable speaking out, right? That obligation to dissent or speak up if you have a different point of view, because ultimately we get to a better answer and it's better for the company.
It is not easy to come in a president or a CEO role or president and move into CEO role very quickly, even if the values are incredible and the team's incredible. What was your process coming in to get up to speed on what the business really was? I mean, every company's a covered dish. We all know this, right? Yeah. You start a new job, you think it's one thing, and you're like, oh my gosh, why'd they put raisins in this? That makes no sense, right? It's human. Oh my gosh. So what was your process coming in to get your arms around the business to figure out what you really needed to attack first?
So when I came in, I think I had perspective that I wouldn't have had I not just lived through COVID. I mean, it was the biggest crisis that I've ever managed through in my professional career, right? To think about your entire business being shut down, you have no revenue coming in, you have a massive burn rate, and you have thousands of employees who are all looking at you. That was a crisis, you know, even after 3 months when Matt King told me he was leaving, I was like, I'll figure it out. I had a certain comfort with ambiguity. I had a comfort with solving very complicated problems. So my thought process was to actually go back to some of the first principles from being a consultant, but I leveraged my team heavily.
Yeah, and it strikes me also that in addition to the commitment to dissent, I can't tell you the number of times I've said this to junior members of team, like the three most powerful words anyone can say in most settings are, I don't know.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so there's a humility that comes with saying, like, well,
exactly,
I may have my own perspective, but I don't know. I'm curious because one of the knocks on most consulting firms is come in, it's incredibly sharp analysis, et cetera, but ultimately you make a set of recommendations and then you don't live with the consequences of the recommendations you make and how they're implemented. Did living with the consequences of decisions that you were making change how you affected things at Ticketmaster, FanDuel, as you transitioned from consultant world to operator?
Yeah, for sure. And I will say when I made that initial transition from being a partner at McKinsey to an operating role at Ticketmaster, you learn a lot, right? You learn exactly what you just said, which is at the end of the day, you live with the results. And so you need to very quickly learn this dose of pragmatism, right? Around coming up with a great strategy that is never going to be able to be implemented is not that helpful. So being able to really think about, okay, at the end of the day, what is the North Star? How do we make sure that, you know, we've got real clarity around what those big bets are, but that we've got an organization who can embrace them and implement them. But I also made some changes in the team, right? As we thought about where's the business going, we were on a rocket ship.
And it can be really tricky because the host can reject the organ transplant quickly. For another business leader who is going through this transition right now and who's already locked in their key people but has identified, okay, these are the roles we have to fill. We're here at Super Bowl week, so you know, we need a left tackle.
Exactly.
We need a strong safety, whatever it is.
You don't want all quarterbacks on the field.
You can't have them, right? And by the way, you can't have all Kobe's. Like, you need a team with some Derek Fishers and some other role players
on
them. What's the advice that you would offer another business leader who's going through this process where they're trying to make sure the host doesn't reject that organ transplant, where they're going to mesh the old people with the new people really effectively?
First, I do think it's really important to bring the team, your top team, along on the journey, right? I had a very clear perspective of where I wanted to go, and I could have just drawn the org chart and said, here you go, here's the new structure, but I knew we would have organ rejection. And so we went through a very thoughtful process, and that was one of the few instances where I actually did use a third party to help, because there's always a lot of emotion. And anytime you're doing organizational work, there's as much art and judgment as there is science, right? You can do benchmarks, you can look at other companies, and we did all of that. Org work is not the easiest work, but the last thing I'll say on is, it's always better to do it from a position of strength. If you wait too long, you're playing defense.
Still ahead, more with FanDuel CEO Amy Howe on what it will take to unlock legal online sports betting in California. Hey folks, Jeff Berman here. Exciting news. Applications are now open for the Masters of Scale Summit.
It's happening October 20th through October 22nd in San Francisco, and it is a really special event. Please join our curated community of founders, innovators, and leaders shaping the future. Expect ideas that challenge your assumptions and connections that move your business and maybe even your life forward. It's an experience that can change literally everything. Apply now at mastersofscale.com/apply26. That's mastersofscale.com/apply26. AI breakthroughs are quickly reshaping every industry around the world: healthcare, education, science, entertainment, and beyond. But true global scale only happens when the underlying infrastructure can maintain pace with the rapid speed of innovation. As the essential cloud for AI, CoreWeave is a purpose-built cloud made for the real demands of today's most complex AI models, bringing the pace, performance, and partnership leading pioneers need to continue pushing boundaries. Ready for anything? Ready for AI. To learn more about how CoreWeave powers the world's best AI, go to coreweave.com/readyforanything.
While everyone was debating whether or not Bitcoin was an asset for their portfolio, CoinShares was quietly building the foundation to invest in it properly. CoinShares launched the world's first Bitcoin ETP back in 2015. Today, they manage nearly $6 billion and are profitable through multiple market cycles. CoinShares is publicly traded on NASDAQ Stockholm and announced in September it is seeking a U.S. listing. CoinShares is the one-stop shop for digital asset investment, passive ETFs, active strategies, and mining exposure. Every approach built to institutional standards. CoinShares. The adults have arrived. Learn more at coinshares.com.
Welcome back to Masters of Scale. You can find this conversation and much more on our YouTube channel. And be sure to check out the link in the show notes to subscribe to our newsletter. Amy says the recent addition of prediction markets is a full circle moment for FanDuel.
A lot of people don't even know this, but the original founders of FanDuel, the product even before it became a daily fantasy sports product, was a prediction market product, an exchange. And the reason they ended up pivoting into daily fantasy sports is because the insight was all the volume was, a lot of the volume, right, was on sports. And so they ended up pivoting the product to a daily fantasy sports product. And it's interesting, as somebody who has three boys and they for years have had their daily fantasy sports leagues, and you know, on Sunday they're watching Sunday Ticket with four different games when all I want to do is actually watch my Buffalo Bills.
A bit of a masochistic endeavor, but
know,
okay,
I
fair.
Know.
Yeah.
But you understand why fantasy sports and now sports betting are so powerful, because everybody knows everything about the player stats, and they're following, you know, every move that each of the different players are playing. And so before prop bets were even a thing in the U.S., you know, the daily fantasy sports business was really kind of paving the way for the business that we have today.
The court issued the ruling it did in 2018. What did it unleash?
That was the moment where real money wagering, sports betting, and iGaming was now legal. And it was up to the states to decide, right? There was no longer a federal ban on online sports betting. So state by state, you could decide if you wanted to legalize sports betting and iGaming. And, you know, there were early advocates like Governor Christie, but there were, you know, New Jersey and Pennsylvania and, you know, Michigan and a number of states that legalized quite quickly. And what we found is that there was just phenomenal demand. And, you know, for us, we had a huge advantage because we had a very engaged set of users who were all already using our daily fantasy sports product, right? And so we were able to migrate them over beautifully to our online sports betting product. Mm. Now, fast forward to 2026, we're sitting here, Super Bowl weekend. There are 25 states, 50% of the U.S. can bet legally online, but 50% can't.
Well, and there are loopholes that are being exploited all over the place, which I want to get to. But that created a dynamic where it emerged that there was effectively a duopoly in the marketplace, right? It was you all and another company that starts with a D, and we'll leave it at that.
Who we collaborate with all the time, right? I mean, we're part of a sports betting alliance. And that's one of the great things, by the way, about this industry is we work together to safely open up and regulate.
Well, so, you're in coopetition, right? Yeah, I mean, because exactly. The rising tide will lift all boats with a more permissive regulatory framework. So that makes a ton of sense. But you came in when it was still functionally a duopoly. What was it like coming into a marketplace where you're going head to head with a competitor, where I'm trying to remember 2020, 2021, what customer acquisition costs were in your category, but they were astronomical. What was that like in that moment for you?
Well, it's interesting because you're right. In the early days, there was a lot of money spent on marketing, but there was a lot of learnings along the way, right? Trying to figure out what league deals do you need to do? What teams do you want to partner with? What media stations do you want to align with? And how do we think about the role of TV versus, you know, digital? And I think we brought a lot of sophistication and discipline to that in the very early days, and that served us well over the years.
So you referenced the emergence of prediction markets. This has been explosive growth over the last year, 18 months. How is that changing, first, the competitive landscape, and second, how you're leading FanDuel?
Yeah, I think the important thing to remember is the North Star is still to legalize and offer our industry-leading sports betting product in every state we can, right? It's a superior offering. We love prediction markets in the states that aren't legal because it gives us a nice complementary offering. But it has shifted the landscape. As a CEO, it's a constant reminder that you have to be able to be agile and pivot as the landscape evolves. And one of the things that I think FanDuel has done a very good job of is there's been uncertainty, as you know, as we've been talking about through this conversation, for well over a decade. And so we know how to navigate that uncertainty. We're in a volatile business to begin with, right? The nature of what we do is uncertain and volatile. And so there's a certain DNA that we have, but you also have to figure out how to build agility into your business model and the organization.
We're having this conversation in the great state of California. I cannot use your core product in California. Why not?
So California is a very ripe topic. And let me just to contextualize the question, think about this. There is easily a $10 billion illegal market in California. The demand is there, right? You've got 13% of the population, and that's probably a conservative number. The reason you can't is because it needs to be, we tried to get it on the ballot in 22 and we weren't successful. We are working very successfully right now with and through the tribes. At the end of the day, the most important driver of legalizing sports betting in California will be working with the tribes to make sure that we can protect tribal sovereignty. There are well over 100 tribes in the state of California, and we learned our lesson in the 22 election. We tried to align with them and we weren't successful. Coming out of that, we completely rebooted our strategy. I hired folks who came from the tribes, and so they're working alongside. But we know we need to, spend a lot of time listening. We were on an extended apology tour. Mm-hmm. And we're working with them right now to figure out how do we safely open up California in a way that works for them. And ultimately, I'm cautiously optimistic that we'll get there, but we'll do it on their timeline.
I'm just not sure that it's intuitive for everyone why legalizing online sports betting would be a threat to tribal sovereignty.
Well, if you think about it, their primary existence is brick and mortar casinos, right? And I think it was, one of the eye-opening moments for me after we weren't successful in November of 22 was COVID was an existential threat to their business, right? It was the first time that brick and mortar casinos were, I think, ever really shut down for an extended period of time. As you think about that and you think about the role of the tribes is to make sure that they can provide for future generations, they rightly so, although we have lots of data to refute it, but they view legalizing sports betting as a potentially slippery slope to legalizing iGaming, which they're concerned could cannibalize their brick and mortar business. And we do have lots of evidence that online gaming does not. However, at the end of the day, they're the most critical constituent in California. And so, we've been working very closely with them, but that's really the core reason, right? And, not only do we have to get the tribes comfortable, but it has to successfully have a majority vote in the state of California.
And when you're working on something like this, which really is not just a FanDuel challenge, this is an industry-wide challenge, how are you interfacing with the other players in the space so that ideally your interests can be aligned and you can work with the tribes for the best outcome for everyone, including the tribes, including your business, yeah, your customers, and for Californians.
It's a very unique industry, right? Because there aren't that many industries where you are competing head-to-head with a number of different operators, but at the same time, you have to collaborate, right, to safely open up the market. So we have an organization that's called the Sports Betting Alliance, and most of the legal regulated online operators are part of this, and we work as an organization to safely, you know, lobby and work with the key stakeholders, may vary state to state, but the role of the SBA is to make sure that we can provide the necessary support and infrastructure to, you know, to legalize and open up the state. And, you know, for the audience that may not understand, why is it important to legalize sports betting? Because, you know, this habit has existed for years. It's, you know, I'd say a few things. One is, as a legal online operator, I'm licensed in every state that we're in. We have to verify that you are who you say you are. You can't engage in real money wagering until you're 21 years old. So we're protecting underage gambling. We're providing safeguards to consumers, right? Responsible gaming. But importantly, we're providing revenue for the states, right? Since PASPA was repealed, or since we started to operate in the U.S., FanDuel's generated over $6 billion in tax revenue for the states. And that goes to causes of the, you know, that are important to the states, whether it's first responders or mental health or education. And that's a meaningful number, right? But if we were to open up the remaining states, there's easily another $1.6 billion per year that the states could generate.
We each have three kids. They're roughly in the same age range. My youngest is now 16. He's my avid sports fan. He obviously cannot have his own account. but I have one. And I would rather work with him on what I don't believe is an oxymoron, which is responsible gaming.
Yeah.
But it does give rise to a serious conversation here, yeah, about the risks here, right? We've got huge risks with addiction. We have risks of people way overspending their means. We're in the middle of a loneliness epidemic in this country, and taking these behaviors online only contributes to that. I'm curious, first, when you took the job or when you're considering taking the job, how that played in. How do you handle that?
Well, I actually thought a lot about it before I took the job, and I had a conversation with my husband, and I thought, as a female CEO who has three boys, who, you know, I could see that, you know, at the time they were obviously quite a bit younger, they're now teenagers, but I knew how much they loved daily fantasy sports, and you could see where, you know, ultimately this might go. At the end of the day, the most important thing, we are building a business for the long term, right? And if we don't continue to earn the trust of our, not just our core customers, but all of our stakeholders, which are, you know, the state regulators, it's the leagues, it's the teams, it's everybody that works in this ecosystem, we're not going to have a successful business in the long run. And I'm really proud of what we've done. I truly believe that we're not just the market leader from a commercial perspective, but we are leading the market from a responsible gaming perspective. You know, if you look at our global parent company, Flutter Entertainment, we've spent easily over $100 million a year on responsible gaming tools, on educating and creating awareness around this. And I will tell you, as the mom of three boys, I feel an even greater obligation because I go to college campuses. You know, you go to Texas, that also is not legal, and betting is rampant.
Yeah. Grateful that you do that. And I really hope a male CEO would do the same and take that obligation equally seriously. And I appreciate that perspective as a mom, but male CEOs don't get off the hook on that.
Fair. you're absolutely right.
You are an athlete. You were a competitive athlete growing up. There's remarkable data on the correlation, at a minimum, between women in the C-suite and being involved in competitive athletics growing up.
Yeah.
I'm curious about how your experience as a competitive athlete has informed your professional career.
It's shaped me a lot as a leader, as a professional, as a team member. I was a competitive gymnast growing up. I was a swimmer. I played tennis. And I think you learn a lot from sports. It's one of the things that my husband and I have instilled in all of our boys. I think there's a certain humility you learn when you lose. I think you learn how to win with integrity and professionalism. You learn how to be a leader of a team. You learn how to, you know, how to figure out how to build a high-performing team. as we were joking earlier, you can't create a team of all quarterbacks. That doesn't work. And I, you know, and of course, you're, you know, when you grow up as a professional, or a, not a professional athlete, but a competitive athlete, you learn that you want to be number one, right? There's a sense of competition and drive that comes with growing up as an athlete. And I think I've taken all of those elements into, you know, ultimately becoming a CEO. I'd never set out to be a CEO, but here I am and I absolutely love it. But I think those early days of being an athlete were actually quite instrumental.
Several years ago, my last company, I was part of the team that helped launch a company called Together, where Alex Morgan, Sue Bird, Chloe Kim, and Simone Manuel were our founding, the much more important founders of that company. And we had a belief that this boom-bust cycle that we've seen in professional women's sports, we were exiting that and we were entering a more sustained rise in it, which we've really seen over the last 6-7 years, give or take. I have been of the belief that one of the things that can really accelerate the growth of women's sports is gambling. One, because they tend to be taking place in the off-season for the most popular betting sports among men's sports. Has the Caitlin Clark effect been real for FanDuel? How have you seen the growth of women's sports since you've been in the chair of FanDuel?
The Caitlin Clark effect has definitely been real. In fact, I think that we saw a, you know, several 100% increase in WNBA betting when she came on the scene. But I think this is, as you can imagine, this is something that was near and dear to my heart when I stepped into the CEO role. And I think about it as, you know, there's kind of three different pillars to it. One is providing equity in the product, right? So if you looked at our WNBA product years ago, it was not nearly as good as our NBA product, right? So making sure that we've got a betting product that is as good as, you know, the equivalent men product. Second, partnering up with female athletes and leagues, right? We were one of the first sponsors of the WNBA. We've had a number of amazing female ambassadors that are part of our team. And I will say we still have work to do, right? I mean, if you look at the data, NFL is a great example, closer to 40% of, you know this, right? NFL consumers are women, and we're not nearly where we need to be in terms of the percentage of bettors that are women. But, you know, sometimes the sports betting product is overly complicated, not for just for women, but for men as well. And so as we continue to really advance technology and think about how we leverage AI and Gen AI to personalize the experience and make it more intuitive and simple, I think that's going to be a real unlock for targeting more women in the category.
And that's a perfect segue. As we sit here, Super Bowl week 2026, having this conversation, we almost have to talk about AI. You're in an interesting position in that you can leverage AI to improve your business, improve your products. And also you have to think defensively about the use of AI to game your system, I imagine. How are you approaching each of those?
I think you have to approach it with a fair bit of humility that you don't know everything, but a significant amount of intellectual curiosity to make sure that you can provide the right environment for your team to embrace it and learn, you know, and get up to speed. Some of the areas that I'm most excited about are how we can use the technology to really improve the fan experience, but also build more trust into the product, right? So we've got a product called Ace AI, which is effectively, think about it as a betting companion. So instead of consumers used to leave the site or the app and they'd go and do all their research on stats and look at odds and figure out what do they want to bet on, what kind of parlay do they want to build, and then they'd come back into the app. Well, you can do that all within Ace AI seamlessly and place your bet right within that interface. So that, you know, that's just one example. There's, you know, an infinite opportunity to figure out how we leverage that technology. But we're also really proud of how we're using AI to build trust into the product. And what I mean by that is, you know, we're using what we call real-time check-in tools. So we have built very sophisticated models that are leveraging, you know, large language models and a lot of data and science to say, you know, gosh, I'm seeing some signs of change in behavior that may not be normal. We ought to do a check-in and make sure that everything is okay, right? And so that's the kind of, and when we talk about at the end of the day, building a business that is sustainability for the long term, these are the types of things that are really important.
What about defensively? Are you worried about people almost weaponizing AI with regard to your platform?
Listen, there's always, I mean, you always have sharp customers. The technology is very good for facilitating research and being able to compare odds more effectively across the platform, but we don't think it's going to give you a mathematical edge.
Yeah. I want to go back to prediction markets for just a moment. Are there things that we shouldn't be able to bet on?
Yes, absolutely. When we set out to think about how we wanted to enter prediction markets, one of the important things for us was we wanted to make sure we had a partner that was philosophically aligned and had the same core principles as us. And that's why we ended up partnering with the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. And I can tell you, Terry Duffy, the CEO of the CME Group, and I spent a lot of time talking about that. You know, I'm not going to comment on what other players have decided to offer or not. What I can tell you is, what we are doing is bringing the same level of integrity to the markets that we're going to offer. If you offer a market that can be easily manipulated, we're not going to offer the market, right? So we are consciously choosing maybe to be a bit slower and more cautious to make sure that the markets that we do are legitimate and above board. At the end of the day, you know, the CFTC will determine these guardrails, mm-hmm. and we're very excited. We're going to be meeting with the new chairman, Michael Selig, and I think we can, there's a lot of value that we can bring to those conversations because we've been operating in a market for a very long time with proper safeguards for the consumer, but also an ecosystem that can manage the integrity of sports betting. And I think we can bring a lot of that thinking to prediction markets.
Right. And I think the corollary to whether it can be easily manipulated is, what are the consequences of it being manipulated? Right. Are there life and death consequences? Will a country lose its sovereignty? I mean, and so I appreciate that these are real conversations and that the answer to that
question is
that there are some things that we should not be able to bet on. Your oldest is in college. You go visit, and one of the classmates says, "I'm really like excited about entering the workforce, and I'm also incredibly trepidatious because, boy, this is all changing really quickly." What's the advice you're giving that young person when they ask you?
It's funny because I reflect on what it was like when I was graduating, when you were graduating, and there's a lot of pressure on kids nowadays. My advice is, give yourself time to get exposure to a lot of different things, right? When you're 19, 20, 21 years old, how do you know what you want to do, right? I happened to go into consulting really because it was a sliding door moment. I thought I was going to actually go back and take over my dad's family business. That was a terrible business. And so I ended up going into consulting and, you know, lo and behold, got exposure to a lot of different things. When you're young, what you don't have is exposure and pattern recognition yet. And so finding ways to figure out, give yourself some time to figure out what you want to do. For me, consulting was great because I got a lot of exposure to different industries, different types of problems. Your learning curve is very steep, but there's a lot of different ways to have a career. The other thing I would say is, you know, for me, I'm sure for you as well, my whole career has been sliding door moments, right? Those unexpected turns that take you in one direction. And I think one of the things that's been really helpful for me is I was always willing to walk through doors that were open for me, that I wasn't necessarily planning on walking through. But once I did, it opened up a whole new world. And so sometimes you might know exactly what you want to do, and that's great, and that's the path you're on. But a lot of times, you know, you don't know. And so spend the time, be intellectually curious, and definitely spend time building a network because, you know, it's, as it turns out, careers are very long and you never know how those relationships will come back and factor in.
And those human connections cannot be displaced by AI.
That is exactly right. That's exactly right.
Great place to wrap. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Amy Howe for joining us. As more and more Americans bet on sports, play casino-style games, and wade into prediction markets all from their phones, Smart Money says this industry will continue its astronomical rise. That said, to get through this without exacerbating crises, we will need experienced leaders like Amy who are poised to lead us into that future with a focus on creating sustainable, responsible companies. I'm Jeff Berman. Thank you for listening.
This is Zeb Farbman, co-founder and CEO of Lightrix, a technology company that creates AI-powered video models and tools.
Most of our research was along the border between computer graphics and image processing. And we thought that if we pair our expertise with this new platform, we were able to create new tools and new creative experiences that no one did before.
But when the generative AI boom disrupted everything, Lightrix seized the moment with a new burst of innovation. They created LTX2, an open source AI model enabling its users to generate high quality video content, giving them full creative control from concept to delivery on one platform.
I think a lot of the values that we took from academia reflect how we are thinking about our models. We want them to be open. We want a collaborative environment. And we really, really care about efficiency. We always believe deep research is the key to unlocking a competitive advantage and building cool things. It's even more important during the age of AI.
Start creating today with LTX2 at ltx.studio.
Hey, folks, if you enjoyed our recent episode with my friend Matt Abrahams, the brilliant author and academic has his own podcast, Think Fast, Talk Smart. Twice a week, the Stanford lecturer sits down with experts to discuss their best advice to hone and develop your communication skills. Learn to stress less about public speaking, make more meaningful small talk, and much more. You'll always get science-backed strategies and actionable tips you can use right away. And Matt is just a fantastic guy. You're going to love having him in your ear. Listen to Think Fast, Talk Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm PJ Vogt. My podcast, Search Engine, has a new two-part series for you. Of all the new technologies coming out of AI, the most transformative one might be driverless cars. They're already on the road in 10 American cities, and they're quickly coming to more. We tell the story of how we got here. The secret team at Google that spent 15 years building what might be the safest vehicle on the road. And we cover the fights brewing in blue cities, where unions and politicians are working to keep those cars off the streets. Listen to Search Engine wherever you get your podcasts.
Masters of Scale is a Wait What original. Our executive producer is Eve Tro. Our senior producer is Trisha Bobita. Associate producer is Masha Makatanina. Senior talent executive is Stephanie Stern. Mixing and mastering by Aaron Bastinelli and Brian Pugh. Original music by Ryan Holiday. Our head of podcasts is Lital Molad. Visit mastersofscale.com to find the transcript for this episode and to subscribe to our newsletter. And please make sure to check out our YouTube channel.